Yeah, that was the Kinks, the Ape Man. I am the Ape Man. First heard that song in the movie Club Paradise, if you remember, with Eugene Levy and Robin Williams. And there you go. An amazing song, the Kinks. Tonight, it is the Hesses, Steve and Don Hess. Author Ron Felber. The book is The Mojave Incident. More with Steve and Don Hess and Ron Felber when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. George will be back on Monday. We're talking with author Ron Felber of The Mojave Incident and Steve and Don Hess, who have finally decided to come forward and tell about their story out in the Mojave Desert. Happened in 1989. And they've changed their names in a couple of, in Ron's second version of the story. You guys, in the original version, you left your names in. Was that a problem over the last few years? Is that why you guys decided to go fully undercover?
It wasn't a problem. Honestly, when we met with Ron and we wanted to organize these thoughts and have them recorded, honestly, we didn't even think the book would be published. And we did have small children at the time, and we were concerned about them. We were concerned about our families. We were concerned about society and whether the social climate, you know, I don't think that was 25 years ago that society was really accepting of the whole UFO phenomenon, abductees and everything. So we did have a problem with that.
Well, what's important, Don and Steve, and I want to thank you for coming forward. What is most important is that you do speak and that you do talk about it, because if Ron hadn't have taken the initiative, if with everything that happened, and we've got a lot more to discuss tonight, but then if the story never got out there, then that doesn't do anybody any good. Right. You need to talk about it. And just what if there's somebody out there that has a similar experience that doesn't want to talk about it? They listen to you guys tonight on Coast, and they go, you know, that's what happened to us, or something. And then they talk, and that's what's most important. And I have to thank you. You know, it's a very, very big step. And thank you for all of that. Now let's get to the scary stuff, which is this. Okay, now, to me, The red blinking eyes, which have surrounded your pickup truck at you know, by your guesstimation, it could be in the thousands. These little creatures are floating and bouncing in the bushes around, looking in the windows, red eyes. Then these two sentries, if you will, glowing. They're 4 feet tall, 3 feet around. They look like plugs or something. They have a weird description, but they're glowing. And they are at the back of the truck, and they are making sure that you guys don't goof around or do anything foolish, right?
Right.
Now, that is where things are at. Steve, do you have your gun cocked and ready, or have you thought that that's maybe a bad idea and you've put that down?
At that point in time, it was definitely a bad idea.
So right.
They basically surrendered it, put it down, but, you know, at this point in time, those impish, mischievous creatures were causing havoc and jumping all around, trying to scare the crap out of us, which they already had succeeded. And at this point in time, we thought, well, we're going to die right now.
Were you thinking the same thing, Don? And did you, were you and Steve actually talking to each other? I'm thinking if it's me and my wife, I might be too scared to yell or scream or talk, because I'm looking and observing. Were you guys actually talking to each other?
Not for a little while. We were totally just trying to take it all in and you know, about to go into cardiac arrest, I think. We really thought we were about to die. But then Steve actually did say, you know, you've got to, like, pinch me or punch me or something. And I'm like, what? And he's like, pinch me. Are we awake? Are we seeing this? You know?
That's an interesting observation. He wanted to make sure that he wasn't dreaming, right?
Right.
And did one of you ask the other what I would have asked? Are you seeing the same things that I am seeing? Did you guys have that conversation?
Absolutely. Steve said, are you seeing this? Pinch me. Pinch me.
And okay, now what happens next? Now that we've set everything up, Steve has put the gun down. We have the sentries. You're getting encircled. What happens next?
Well, we're about to go into total panic mode, and Steve decides he wanted to see if he could communicate with them and perhaps even approach them. So he put his hand up like to get out of the truck, and he felt like electrical kind of energy and knew that he couldn't. And as he went forward, they came forward, so he came back and we're starting to hyperventilate.
Steve, what were you thinking? Were you thinking cardiac arrest?
I thought that was going to be the case, and it was kind of weird because when we talk about these sentinels that were there monitoring us, I thought
Right.
they were monitoring our life vitals as well. And, like I said, brought us to the brink. And at that time, it did kind of change where we got I don't know, it almost seemed like it was almost like a fog or a breeze that came in and slowed our heart rates down and put us to a place where I didn't think my heart was going to explode in my chest any longer.
And Don, what was one of you more active than the other?
Steve was probably more active. He went into protector mode, of course,
Right.
and I went into I'm going to die mode. I don't know.
And so at that point, Steve, what did you try to is resuscitate the right word? What were you trying to, because you didn't know what was affecting Dawn at this point.
Well, I think, like I said, this kind of happened to both of us where we both kind of calmed down and we caught our breath. It almost seemed like the creature's intensity of what they were doing, kind of running around, jumping in on the truck and looking at us, kind of calmed down just a bit. And it was about that time, once we re-calmed down, that they could look out and see at this point the mothership was coming through the valley. And that's when I caught the glimpse of it. And we looked up above us, and it was so large it covered the entire valley, and it moved in right from the area where they came from and came across the valley and just capped it. And it was almost cloaked that you could look up there. We could see the distinctive edge of it as it came across the valley. But when it was on top of us, it almost looked like you could see right up and see some stars, or it was cloaked like stars, but we knew it wasn't.
What were the creatures doing, the red-eyed creatures?
They kind of calmed down for a second because of that thing. At that time, things started to change a bit. And this is kind of the next phase, I think, of the things that we saw when we saw smaller ships underneath this big ship that actually started coming down. And at this time, we started seeing kind of like the searcher lights that we described going across the desert. And it was almost in a. They were a round ship that had a large arm appendage. It was almost like a large light bulb that shot a laser beam in a triangle shape that was very thin, very specific, and extremely bright. And they were kind of combing the desert at the time. And we could see things being beamed up and being shot back down. And just about that time happened that another set of creatures appeared and came.
Were they working? Was it some kind of, I'm picturing almost like maybe farm equipment or mining equipment. Was it, were they working? Were they doing something? Were they looking for something?
To me, that was definitely the case. They looked like they were looking and searching for something very specific because the way the pattern that they used going through the desert, they were combing it in a very distinct way. And again, there were sounds that we heard at that time as well. Some of the other things that came along with it would be like a low hydraulic hum noise that we could actually hear. And it was at this time that I guess we call them the grays appeared, more of what we would determine a traditional alien would look like.
Right.
And
And the mothership, we're going to get to the that in a second. But right as you were describing that, I'm just going to let you know something vibrated under my feet here in the studio. I'm not making this up. And I just wrote a note to Nathan, and I said, I felt something under my feet. And he's freaking out, and we're kind of looking up. And the studio was dark. And, we're like terrified. Okay.
That's okay. Our lights flickered in the house, so.
That was kind of strange. And, I'm kind of freaked out right now. So this mothership has got 5, 6, 7, or 8 smaller ships that are dangling, right? They're like coming down on some kind of, I don't want to say string because it's not, but a cable, right?
They're more like independent. They just more like attached and detached and floated down.
Right.
Combing the surface.
And the mothership is huge. How big are these smaller ships? They're still huge too, but in relation to the mothership, they're small. That's fascinating. And were they lit up?
They did have a more of a white light kind of pattern around them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we didn't see different color lights. They were typically all white lights, and they did kind of use that same kind of blinking communication to each other as we've seen them searching out through the desert.
Now, how did the, when you say the typical grays, I want a description of that, but how did they descend? How did they get there?
I think they were beamed down out of those ships.
Did you actually see them get beamed down?
You seen things in the beam, going up and down.
Right. Like an elevator? Like
cows or something like that to see. But it was still a ways from us when this happened. When they started searching, they kind of worked all the way to the far end of the valley.
Right.
Working their way back towards us.
Don, what did you see? How did you think the grays got there?
I don't know, honestly. It just seemed like, you know, well, we were preoccupied with, you know, watching spaceships and laser beams coming down on the desert. So we were rather preoccupied until they were just there.
Did you guys ever disagree?
On what?
Just on anything as to what you saw, or pretty much did you guys agree and see the same thing?
Oh, yeah. We never disagreed. We saw the same thing, smelt the same thing, heard the same thing or didn't hear the same thing.
Right. So me and my wife, we don't agree on anything. So I just had to ask.
Sure.
So the grays, when you say grays, there was more than one.
Mm-hmm.
How tall were they?
Like maybe 5 feet, maybe 4 feet.
And when you say gray, describe them for me, Dawn.
Well, I think we're using that term grays like it's used in media. But they were that traditional large head, toddler body, long spindly, you know, appendages, the big almond eyes, tiny slit for a mouth, virtually no nose, you know, just when you see aliens represented, these were honestly what they looked like.
What happened with the blinking red eye guys?
Well, they kind of started disappearing.
Did you think at any point, and certainly Steve, did you think that maybe this was going to end? You know, was there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When things retreated, did you think maybe you were going to live? You know, did you get to that point before it got, you know, a little bit crazier?
I absolutely thought that was part of the ordeal, is it would be back and forth like that. So it's almost like a teaser. So kind of as we saw these red creatures leaving, I'm starting to feel, you know, maybe this is done, they're gone, they're taking off, then the next wave would start over again.
Right.
That's what happened with the grays. The fact that they appeared right after the other ones kind of dissipated or kind of left a little bit.
Were the sentinels still there when the grays showed up?
Yes.
So they never left, did they?
No.
Did you ever have the opportunity to, I can't remember if this was in the book or not, so I have to ask, did you ever touch the sentinels? Did you ever get close enough to them to check them out?
I probably got within 3 feet of them, but never touched them.
Were they translucent or were they solid? You know, I picture them as like glowing fire hydrants. You know, that's I could be wrong, but you know what I mean? The stout tree stump kind of shaped, you know, muscular short kind of thing, but it was glowing. Am I right in that description?
I wouldn't say it was so much glowing, but it did have some kind of essence to it. It wasn't bright at all.
Right.
It was definitely a darker color. And, but yeah.
But it was their job to make sure that you two behaved.
Behave or make sure that we didn't die initially before they were done with us.
That's interesting. So kind of both ways, just to make sure that you guys were there to finish what they were there to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Okay, so the Grays arrive. How many of them were there?
I don't recall exactly how many, probably 7 to 9. They were able to, like, surround the whole truck.
Wow. And were you guys still in the vapor state? Were you guys calm? Were they there, you know?
It goes initially calm until they actually showed up, because, I don't know, I had the feeling that I thought when they initially came, that's probably when more of the telepathic stuff started and when we had can hear them.
Right.
In mind. And I thought that was kind of their deal. But kind of getting back to, you know, what we're, you know, Don and I checking each other the whole time during the night, we were confirming, seeing, asking about each other, and it almost seemed to a point then that we almost became telepathic to be able to talk to each other with our minds as well.
And this is where the emotional stuff started to happen. And we're going to take a break here in just a second. But when we come back from the break, we need to do a couple of things, because I want to take some phone calls at the top of the hour. We need to get through the emotional part and then get to the regression stuff that happened on the East Coast. And we're going to wrap all of that up and then get to some phone calls at the top of the hour. My guests tonight are Steve and Don Hess. Ron Felber, the author of The Mojave Incident, has been patient and in the background because Steve and Don Hess have never talked about this in public, and they are sharing everything with Coast to Coast for the very first time tonight. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me on Twitter at JChurchRadio. Twitter is going crazy, by the way, Steve and Don. Thank you so much. And we'll be back right after this short break. Yeah, that was pretty strange. Something under my feet, listening to Steve and Don tell their story. And I wrote a note right here. I wrote a note and flashed it at Nathan in the middle of the interview. And I'm trying to be cool here in the studio. I'm here to tell you it really happened. And I just posted it on Twitter if you want to go check it out. At J Church Radio. One of the best preserved mummies in the world isn't from Egypt or Peru, but it comes from Italy about 90 years ago. Rosalia Lombardo was a 2-year-old Italian girl who died of pneumonia, and her father, he was an official named Mario Lombardo, grieved her death and went to an embalmer, Alfredo Salafia, in an attempt to preserve her. Her body was one of the last to be admitted to the catacombs of Palermo in Sicily. You can check out the series of photos of the mummies right now at Coast to Coast AM on the homepage. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Tonight, it is the Mojave Incident. Ron Felber, the author, Steve and Don Hess, for the first time, are talking about their story. This is Coast to Coast AM. More with Steve and Don and Ron when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. George will be back on Monday. We're talking with Steve and Don Hess. Ron Felber is in the background. Now, I kind of want to do a quick recap because it kind of jumps forward here. So the Grays show up. And the blinking eye red guys retreat. The sentries are still there. And at this point, guys, when is it that things end and you wake up in the morning?
Oh, we still have a lot to go through before that happens. We have the Grays that are looking in the window. They start a mind control exercise of some type where they're taking us back to traumatic events in our life. And the events are traumatizing enough to relive them, but the fact that we don't have any control over our thoughts was probably the most horrific of all.
Each one of these thoughts or memories for both of you, had you ever shared any with these thoughts with anybody? Because they were extremely private and, by the way, very difficult to read.
Mm-hmm. No, we not beyond our own families that would know.
Right.
No, never.
And for you, Steve, had, you know, beyond your family, did anybody know these thoughts except for yourself?
I would say no as well.
Did you feel violated? Let me ask, Don, you must have, but did you feel violated at the time?
Absolutely. That was the worst of it. You know, being taken back, that number one, that they knew what happened to me.
Right.
Number two, that they wanted to capitalize on what happened to me for whatever reason. We don't know what their purpose was.
Right.
And the fact that we had no control over it.
Now, the both experiences, I don't want to get into too much detail here because, number one, it's private. So we don't need to go too far with it. But I will describe it a little bit for our audience. Number one, for Dawn, it was a private experience that happened with somebody when she was very young and with a man. And, you know, it's almost fill in the blanks. But, Dawn, I'll let you describe as much as you want briefly about what they implanted in your mind.
Well, I mean, it's in the book. I was attacked as a child. I was 8 years old. In a schoolyard after hours, and they took me back to that moment to relive it. They also took me back to the birth of our first child. He was born with a heart disorder, a hole in his heart. It was devastating at the time, but it closed on its own. So, you know, the moment hearing something like that of a newborn child is when, you know, you freak out a bit. It ended up fine, but they took me back to that moment where we found out, you know, there's something wrong with your newborn child, which was devastating.
And do you think that this happened because they wanted you to react or maybe know what it is to be scared at that moment, like you were when you were 8 years old? There was some intention that they were trying to do. What do you think the reasons for that was?
I mean, we don't know the reasons. It's only speculation on our part, but it seemed, in retrospect, it seemed a bit scientific. If you were measuring an emotion,
right,
or measuring a fear, you know, perhaps even biologically, not only psychologically, that's the only reason I can think that they would do something like that.
And for Steve, I'm gonna paraphrase just a little bit here, Steve, because it's a very involved situation with you. You went up there to hunt. You brought guns with you, and they put the thought in your mind. Again, I'm gonna paraphrase, and I want your reaction to this. But what it's like to know to be shot and to be skinned and to be hunted. Right? And that's, I'm paraphrasing here, but all of that went flooding into your mind, didn't it?
Well, most definitely did. And I think it was, you know, it was kind of a fact when they showed up, you know, we were almost caged in our truck and they were observers walking by, but testing us on all these levels. And the emotional part was probably one of the most difficult parts because it was definitely torture.
That's right. That's right. Now, Steve, have you hunted since?
Yes.
You have?
Yeah.
And what do you think now when you're hunting versus the thoughts that they put in your head, what it's like to be hunted? Do you hunt differently? You know, I'm being serious, too. How has it affected your hunting experience?
Well, I don't think it has in that way. I've always been an ethical hunter. I take what I need to eat, and that's what I do. And I feel, you know, it's part of our existence as humans to be able to have the right to hunt and provide for yourself and food and that. So in some sense, no, but yes, it definitely gives you a feeling of not being on top of that food chain, but being below that level.
Right, right. And I have never read a description like that, the way that it's written in the book. And to have, to be the victim, right? To be on the other side of it, and to experience what the, you know, what the animal is going through, and now you are the one being hunted. It was a pretty terrifying thing, because I don't think any of us really put ourselves in that position, and to think about it in those terms. But they did, and you had to go through that and go through the adrenaline rush of experiencing what a hunted animal experiences.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
It was extraordinary, and it definitely struck an emotion. Certainly did make me think in the future.
So
about my activities, but yes.
Right. Now, you both go through these experiences. You're both given these mental pictures of what you had gone through throughout your childhood. What happens next?
Then we were hyperventilating again. We're back into a panic state where our whole bodily functions are ready to shut down. And all of a sudden, we saw fog rolling in quite rapidly, faster than, you know, fog could roll in. And we smelt a sulfur smell. And actually, as the fog and the mist hit us, even though it was like nauseating, it actually calmed all of our body functions. It basically, I think, was drugging us.
Steve?
I got the same feeling. It was unbelievable. It rolled in and we felt like, well, I wasn't going to die. I thought I was going to die at that moment, but it's definitely, like I said, it was all night a back and forth tug of war, or taking us to the edge and back several times. It wasn't just a single event.
Right, right. Steve, you keep getting quieter.
Well,
I know.
When I talk about this, it's hard to separate the event from my emotions.
Yeah, and I want to thank you. This has got to be tough. So now the fog rolls in, you guys get calmed, if there's another way to put it, and you're both still in the back of the pickup truck.
Yeah.
The red eye guys have retreated. You've got 9 or 10 guesstimating tall grays, or grays, I'm sorry, that have surrounded the pickup truck. The fog rolls in, and then what happens?
I would say after that point in time is when we probably, it was almost like not a break in the action, but somewhat more where nothing was going on with us immediately. We were more observing what was happening as these searchers, kind of the title of the old book is why, were coming much closer and closer to the truck as they kind of completed their search. So we could see these things happening. We're hearing noises, drilling sounds. Our truck at one point in time shakes violently. A lot of very physical things, both sides, smells, sensations that were more physical at that point in time.
Dawn?
Yeah, we were calm enough to talk for a little while. You know, what are they doing? What is that light? Is that something going up and down in that light? And what do you think they're searching for? I mean, we started just having a conversation. We were calm enough to at least have a conversation. I think at that point we figured, well, they haven't killed us yet. Perhaps that's not their motive. And so even though we were scared, we were curious as well. So we were able, you know, to talk about some things.
Okay, so what happens next?
I don't even remember what happens next.
Exactly. Was it the morning at this point?
Well, first there was a deep, like drilling feeling and sound coming from the earth, and we felt like, and it's hard to explain, but it felt like the entire platform of earth, because it's not like the truck was going up in the air, but it felt like we were going up in the air, even though we were still on the ground. So somehow there was a sensation of being rising up into the craft, But we were still in the truck, and the truck was still on the ground.
And just to chime in there, if I may, it was almost like, Jimmy, that they took a scoop of all the dirt and everything around us. Almost the truck felt like it was dragged, but they took like a big chunk and floated the whole thing up with us in it.
Right. And you guys were still sitting on the dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dirt went up with you.
Yeah.
Right.
Into the mothercraft.
I mean, that was the sensation. I don't know what happened because, of course, the next morning when we woke up, the earth was as it should be.
Right. And then, okay, so I want to actually jump ahead really quick. Mm-hmm. You guys split. You guys look for witnesses, and that all of that is in the book. Nobody sees anything and what have you. But then when you get on the freeway, and I found this very strange and cool at the same time. You guys are wondering, you know, was it all a dream? Was it not a dream? That was crazy. That was nuts. You get on the freeway and you're driving back home, and then off in the distance, out in the desert, you see the mining craft, right?
We see the light, right.
And it's out there doing the work.
Well, it wasn't shooting down a beam. It was just following us.
Right, right. And who sees it first, by the way? Was it Steve?
I think I saw it first only because he was driving.
Right.
And so I'm like, you know, we're at that point, we're just numb and like not even talking. We're just driving. And I'm looking out the window and realize there's a light, you know, it's like, wait, is that an aircraft? Is that a star? And it's like, oh no. And then, you know, we got that feeling. It's like, oh no.
It really was real.
Following us.
Right. And I can't imagine, you know, because, you know, it's like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz, right? You want to click your heels three times and just go home.
Yeah.
Right. And then you see this off in the distance, and then it's just a reminder of, last night was real. It happened. And there you go. And you just wanted to get home safe.
Right.
That's a tremendous experience to go through. Now, let's try to wrap up as much as we can, because I do want to take some phone calls. Okay.
Okay.
Let's do that after the break. So then let's jump way ahead. Now the experience has happened. You guys, hook up with Ryan, because you do go home, you tell your parents, Dawn, you do some investigating into UFOs and ufology. Steve, you've got your issues in your life and work life. All of this is inevitable. It has to happen. And it's all in the book, but you do go through this. But eventually, like Ron said at the beginning, you do hook up with Ron. He's an author, but he's also got connections. And you guys head out and agree to meet with a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and agree to go have a conversation.
Right.
Right? So you guys head out. What's the doctor's name?
Dr. Annixter.
Dr. Annixter. And Steve, were you cool with doing this? Now, this was in Washington, D.C., right?
Right.
Yes, it was in Washington, D.C. And I'd say at that point in time, yes, because, you know, obviously, we wanted answers. We wanted to validate what happened to us. We know it was real, something that we could never deny with anything that I've ever known to be the truth. But, you know.
So you go.
Question yourself.
Right. And you meet with Dr. Annixter, and then he suggests regression, right? Is that where things are going next?
Right. So we have, you know, a pretty separately psychiatric workups, you know, one-day counseling to determine, and what they determined was that we had post-traumatic stress syndrome, that they can't say, this is what happened. All they can say is something's happened. And that, you know, in order to help us find answers, they suggest regressive hypnosis.
Which happens. And who goes, we've got 3 minutes, so I want to try to get as much of this in as we can. Who gets regressed? You guys go to Asheville, right?
Uh-huh, North Carolina.
You guys go to Asheville, North Carolina, and you meet with the regression therapist. And what was his name?
Well, it was Dr. Vitone.
Oh, Dr. Vitone was Washington. First,
oh, that's right, 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 right.
And then I went to see Dr. Annixter in North Carolina.
And that's Ron Felber, everybody, just coming in out of the dark. And you're right, Ron, I should have caught that. I'm too wrapped up in the story, and the building is shaking under my feet, and I'm freaking out. I'm just trying to maintain right now. Okay, so you guys go to Asheville and Dr. Annixter, and you get who gets regressed first?
I think it was myself, I believe.
Steve, you were first. And Dom, were you in the room when the regression happened?
No.
You were not. And Dom, when you were regressed, Steve, were you in the room?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Jimmy, for interrupting. We had two separate sessions, one separate and then one
together. And Ron, you were a witness, right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when, oh man, we're going to run out of time. I knew that we were going to do, the story is so epic and so big, and because this is what I want the audience to understand, and please go with me on this. When you think that the story, the episode, the trauma is over for Steve and Dawn, they've got in the car and they're riding home, truly, this is the halfway point of the journey. Would you both of you agree with me on that?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Did you think at any point, because we're up against a break, but you have a child on the way? Oh, we didn't get to that. Okay, you know what? We're going to talk about that after the break. And Steve and Don has the Mojave incident. Ron Felber is with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Steve and Don and Ron when we come back after the break. Stay right there.